committee will come to order. The quorum is present. Do we have a motion to approve the minutes of February 17th? Representative Gardner, would you move the minutes?
Certainly.
Okay. Representative Gardner moves the minutes of February 17th. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. The minutes are approved. Okay. First bill on the agenda is House File 1847. Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And members, I would like to move House File 1847.
Okay. Representative Fritz moves that House File 1847 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Representative Fritz, I understand you have an author's amendment. Would you like to move the DE2 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chairman, if I could, please.
Okay. Representative Fritz moves the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the order in which she'd like to discuss it. Is there any discussion to the DE2? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Okay, the DE2 is adopted. And go ahead, Representative Fritz,
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Explain your
bill.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. Over the last 10 years, the science of cancer treatment has evolved. New oral chemotherapy medicines such as Gleevec for blood cancer, Tykerb for breast cancer, offer not only innovative cancer treatment, but the hope of survivorship. Until recently, frontline cancer chemotherapy drugs have been administered to patients intravenously or by injection while in a physician's office or clinic. Emerging oral chemotherapy drugs are becoming more common and represent the latest advances in cancer treatment. These drugs offer patients a convenient and non-invasive alternative to intravenous and injected therapies. Many of the chemotherapy drugs delivered intravenously lack specificity, killing both cancer and normal cells, and cause unwanted side effects. Oral chemotherapy drugs are often designed to target specific cancer-causing molecules, eliminating cancer cells while avoiding serious damage to other non-cancerous cells. For many oral chemotherapy drugs, there are no intravenous or injected substitutes. This bill is about making sure the cost sharing between cancer patients and health plans for potentially life-saving cancer medicine also evolves. House File 1847 would create parity between patients' out-of-pocket costs of oral chemotherapy medicines and traditional intravenous medicines. Under some private health insurance pharmacy benefit plans, cancer patients pay hundreds or thousands per month in copayments for oral chemotherapy medicines. Yet traditional intravenous chemotherapy is covered under health insurance medical benefits, where the patient usually pays a much smaller office visit copay to access the intravenous or medicine they were prescribed by their oncologist. Copays, coinsurance, and deductibles were not intended to create barriers to health care. Rather, they were intended to foster the responsible use of health care. If Minnesota cancer patients are forced to pay hundreds and thousands per month for oral chemotherapy medicines prescribed to them by their oncologists, then we know the cost-sharing system needs fixing. Cancer patients follow their doctor's directions. If an oncologist prescribes an oral chemotherapy medicine instead of or in addition to a traditional intravenous medicine, that doctor's order should not trigger a subsequent set of economic burdens on cancer patients that are seeking the best outcomes from treatment. And Madam Chair, I could go to the bill if you like. I have, or we could go to our testifiers. I have Dr. Flynn here, an oncologist. I'd like, and David Ahrens, as well?
Whichever you like, Representative Fritz.
Okay, I think we could go to our testifiers.
Okay, we have Dr. Flynn next, and please welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss these important issues with you today that I think do have a substantial impact on cancer patients in Minnesota and will have an increasingly significant impact in just the next few years. I am Dr. Tom Flynn. I am a practicing oncologist, have been in practice for well over 25 years here in Minnesota, and have seen certainly tremendous advances in cancer care over that period of time. There have been significant advances in chemotherapy, and the latest of these, as the Representative Fritz has said, are the development of newer agents, which are more targeted in their effect and can be delivered often as an oral medication. Currently, about 10% of the oncology drugs that we use are in an oral formulation, and the projections would be that that will increase to about 25% by 2013. About 85% of these agents are targeted to a specific molecular abnormality in the cancer cell, and they can be effective when no IV medication is a benefit. In fact, an oral agent for some cancers is the best, not only the best, but the only available effective treatment for that particular patient. In many cases, these medications, while not curative, can provide for substantial prolongation of life, which can be measured in years. A few examples for you to consider. Gleevec was mentioned a minute ago. This is a specific drug for a particular type of leukemia, chronic myelogenous leukemia, and actually is replacing bone marrow transplants as the initial treatment of choice for that condition. I also think about patients I've seen recently, a recent patient with kidney cancer who had suffered spread of their cancer to multiple sites in the body. Two treatment options in general could be considered. One or two of those are oral medications. There's another which is given intravenously, which requires frequent visits, frequent IV administration, and a great deal more inconvenience to the patient without any increased level of effectiveness, but better reimbursed by many health plans than would be the oral medication. Another patient I think about is one who is a dairy farmer in rural Minnesota, who had surgery for colon cancer and needed what we call adjuvant therapy, or chemotherapy given after surgery to reduce the risk of recurrence. One of the standard approaches for that is a chemotherapy regimen that's given intravenously that has to be given over 48 hours around the clock, requires a placement of a intravenous access device, a device that is implanted under the skin in order to be connected to the IV pump. And obviously that would have created tremendous interference with his quality of life and his ability to maintain his livelihood as a farmer. Fortunately, there is an alternative to that, an oral medication that is taken at home, and a medication which unfortunately is often, again, reimbursed at a much different level than intravenous medication, although comparably effective. That patient fortunately had coverage that allowed him to afford that oral medication such that he could maintain his farm and maintain his lifestyle. Regarding the cost of these agents, they can be actually less than IV treatments, which have to be administered by specially trained nurses in facilities with specialized equipment to allow them to be administered safely and accurately. The oral medications are often covered by a different benefit structure than IV therapies, which results in a large out-of-pocket cost to patients, which can be several thousand dollars per month, while the intravenous drugs may have only a small copay. Patients may opt for an even less effective treatment based on the affordability when the oral agent, in fact, is more effective, but given its cost, is prohibitive for the patient to access. Cancer patients should be able to work with their physicians, determine the best course of treatment for their disease, and not be put in a situation where the difference in out-of-pocket cost is such a significant factor that they are forced to choose potentially less effective treatments than would otherwise be available. As we've said, in many types of cancer currently, and we expect in more situations into the future, oral medications are going to be the best option for many patients. We need to address these coverage disparities now before the problem gets worse, So on behalf of the patients that it's our privilege to serve in Minnesota, I ask you to support this legislation. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Flynn. Seeing no questions, we will go on to David Ahrens. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is David Ahrens. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the American Cancer Society in Minnesota. Is there any feedback from the microphone?
Nope.
Everything okay?
Sounds good to me.
Okay, a little feedback in my ear, so that's why I'm asking. I'm going to be brief because I want to make sure you have an opportunity to hear from Roxanne and Robert Tisdale. Robert is a cancer patient currently on oral chemotherapy medicines, and they would like to be able to tell you their story of what they go through in terms of paying for the out-of-pocket costs of oral chemotherapy medicines. And I'll like them to come up and join me at any time. Briefly, the American Cancer Society is the largest voluntary organization solely devoted to the elimination of cancer in the United States and in Minnesota. Cancer is our state's leading cause of death. One out of every two Minnesotans will hear the words, "You have cancer," in their lifetime, or at least are potentially will hear those words. I've had distributed to you the latest data on cancer incidence in Minnesota so that you will that came from the Minnesota Department of Health. The prevention of cancer and its survival is something just about every Minnesotan will experience either firsthand or in relation to a family member or friend. The topic we're here today is about whether cancer patients will be able to access oral chemotherapy medicines, something that is the state of the art and holds great promise. They're an exciting new development in the front line of cancer treatment. They provide convenience and non-invasive alternatives to intravenous and injected therapies. As such, they are a critical treatment option for many cancer patients. As Representative Fritz pointed out and Dr. Flynn pointed out, there can be a big difference in how much cancer patients have to pay toward the cost of an oral chemotherapy drug versus what they might pay to access intravenous chemotherapy if they went into a physician's office. There is inequity and of the coverage under the prescription benefit and medical benefit structures under health insurance. In the past, copayments for prescription drugs were relatively low, particularly for generics. However, these costs have steadily increased. Currently, a prescription drug plan position oral cancer drugs on Tier 4, which is often a plan's specialty tier. A 2009 Kaiser Family Foundation survey found that over three-quarters of workers in employer-based health care plans have plans with three or more levels of tiers of cost sharing. Those in that fourth tier, the average coinsurance is 31% of the cost of the drug. For some patients, they're seeing out-of-pocket costs prescriptions totaling hundreds or thousands of dollars per month. I also asked that was passed around for you as a few patient examples. Their names are redacted because of we want to comply with the HIPAA privacy law, but those are real people, and it says exactly what this person is, male or female, their age, because this bill only applies to people under 65. If we were over 65, we'd be talking about Medicare Part D, and you all would be in Congress right now. But we're under 65, and we're talking about the regulation of state health plans. These are patients that are paying pretty high costs out of pocket per month to access oral chemotherapy medicine. If that same patient were accessing their chemotherapy through the IV, they might pay zero, they might pay $35, they might pay $10, depending on their plan, for a doctor's visit copay. What we're asking here is that just because something is administered orally, the patient shouldn't pay that much more, or should really pay the same as if they were getting the drug intravenously. We're asking for parity, not a new mandate, but parity between this class of drugs. We understand that broad health care reform is needed. We understand that the costs aren't going away. That's what we and the health plan certainly agree on. That's why we support health care reforms that hopefully bring down all of these costs. We want to make sure that health care is affordable for patients. A recent poll of cancer patients found that over the past 2 years, nearly one-third of those under 65 have difficulty affording prescription drugs, and 28 28% of cancer patients nationally have reported not filling a prescription because of the cost. 28%. It's almost a third. That's unacceptable. We can't speculate about the types of drugs involved, but it's evidence of a growing problem. There's also evidence that high cost sharing impacts a physician's treatment recommendations. A recent study published in Health Affairs, a journal, found that a majority of oncologists agree that costs influence decisions regarding which cancer treatments to recommend for their patients. 84% of oncologists stated that patients' out-of-pocket costs expenses influence their decisions. Knowing that cancer may affect all of us, I think we can all agree we do not want costs to affect the decision of whether or not to access cancer treatment. We're deeply concerned about cancer patients' quality of life. Ensuring access to oral chemotherapy drugs is appropriate when those drugs certainly have the potential to improve patients' treatment experience. Oral chemotherapies also deal with an access to care problem in some aspects. If one can say you're in a small business or you're an independent business person and you're at home, working out of your home, but you need to access oral chemotherapy treatment, then you can take your pill and stay at home. You may still have some side effects, but they may also be less than what you might receive if you're under traditional oral chemotherapy drugs. We believe this is also an access to care issue, and in a state like Minnesota, where so many small independent business owners are in rural Minnesota, we believe it's important they're able to afford and access their medicines. I'd like to stop there. You may have questions for me or the other witnesses, but I wanted to introduce you to Roxanne and Robert Tisdale of St. Paul to very briefly tell you their story.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and welcome to the committee. We're going to have to be very brief because the opponents need to have a chance as well, so I can give you just a couple of minutes, but welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape.
All right. My name is Roxanne Tisdale.
And I'm Robert Tisdale.
And we're here to briefly share our story. My husband has cancer, and he was on IV therapy. And with IV therapy, we pay $25 a month for our copay for IV therapy. Now he is on oral medications. It has stopped metastasizing. His cancer has stopped spreading with this oral medication. And I know it's prolonged his life, because he's not supposed to be with us at this particular point in time, but it has prolonged his life. It has bettered our quality of life. Where we find the hardship is paying for the oral medication. And I told myself I wasn't going to cry here. But, and it may not sound like a lot, but it's $300. We are parents of five beautiful, lovely children. And there are nights that we stay up and are we going to be late on our mortgage? Are we going to give the $300 for the oral medication? Do I skip a day or two to prolong our oral medication to get us to our next paycheck? And we are both educated people that work. He's a carpenter by trade. I am an RN. And so it is not... they're on state assistance or anything like that, in that it's difficult for us to make ends meet, just meeting, trying to figure out how we're going to pay. Before he mm-hmm. gets his medicine, it's not something they'll bill you for. Mm-hmm. You have to pay up front before they even send you the oral medication. And so it's been a hardship for mm-hmm. us. And I feel like we're the lucky ones. Even though it's been a hardship. Do you want to say
something? Well, I like to say that, you know, if it wasn't for the oral medication, really I wouldn't be here. All the other medications that they had for me, nothing worked. And this is the only medication that has actually stopped the spread of my cancer, which started in my kidney. And it moved to my liver, it moved to my lungs, and also my lymph nodes, and actually in my eye here. So I just recently had surgery on my eye because of a tumor that was cancerous in my eye. And it is hard with the cost, you know, the extra $300 a month, you know, when we're trying to take care of our children and family. And it would be nice if the cost was the same as it was when you know, I was going to the oncologist. So.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being here and sharing your story with us today. Representative Broad has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Ahrens, I'm just curious about your statement about those over 65. I'm curious what actually happens. I know I'm not in Congress. I'm not fooling myself. But what happens with Medicare? I mean, what is the benefit on the Medicare side related to this issue? I'm just trying to get a sense of where we're at in comparison to that.
Sure. And I'm not going to be the jump up and say I'm an expert on Medicare Part D, but this is why some in Congress are working so hard to close the Part D donut hole, is because of the out-of-pocket costs for prescription drugs under that. I don't know how to compare the problem of Minnesota's under 65 population with access to oral chemotherapy here with the over 65 population and what they experience under the current Medicare prescription program. And maybe Catherine or others can help out with that kind of information, but it's certainly something I can try to get back to you on, but I'm not quite sure how to answer your question of comparing Medicare Part D and that situation with where we are today.
And then,
okay.
Madam Chair, Representative, I just have a quick follow-up, and I don't know if this is best for you, Mr. Ahrens, or for somebody else, and if it's not answerable today, that's fine. When the intravenous treatments are given, there's a drug that is actually administered. Is the drug that is administered charged out as a prescription, or is the drug that's administered charged out as part of the event itself? Does that make any sense? I'm trying to get a sense of the disparity between the treatment of the oral treatment as a drug versus a process.
Sure. Mr. Ahrens.
I can answer that because I put the billing.
Ms. Tisdale. We need to go through the chair here just for
I'm
the
sorry.
Tape. So. Go ahead.
Ms. Tisdale,
go ahead.
It's a part of the event when we go there, and it's billed as part of the event. When it's a prescription, it's a different billing process, and so it's not part of that event. It's just like you going to get your prescription at a medication at a pharmacy. Then we take it a step further because it's a tier four, is we are actually getting a specialty pharmacy to give us this medication. And so we actually go through a specialty pharmacy that we need to pay.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. We're going to give the opponents a chance, or at least the, I don't know, maybe they're not opponents, but we have Cecilia Rattel.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Catherine Kmit as well. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Catherine Kmit from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and with me today is Cecilia Rattel from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm going to go first, and then Cecilia will testify. The council represents 7 nonprofit health plans in Minnesota that provide coverage to 4 million people. It's important to remember that the health plans cover cancer treatments. I want to make that clear, including chemotherapy, both by infusion as well as oral chemotherapy drugs. Chemotherapy for the treatment of cancer is usually administered by injection or infusion and generally occurs in a clinic or outpatient setting. So in response to your question, Representative Broad, it's covered as a medical benefit. Oral chemotherapy is a very positive development for some persons with certain types of cancer. Currently, most benefit plans cover oral chemotherapy drugs under their pharmacy benefit, either as a regular drug or as a specialty formulary drug, as Mrs. Tisdale testified. This bill seeks to equalize how enrollee cost sharing is handled for cancer chemotherapy treatments. The design and pricing of healthcare benefits takes into account many factors, but probably one of the most important factors considered is what the underlying cost structure is of that particular service. All healthcare benefits are developed this way, including chemotherapy treatment. In today's economy, employers are struggling to balance the cost of premiums against out-of-pocket costs, and employers are making these choices as to which plans they can afford based on many factors, including whether they can afford more upfront costs in their premium that comes with lower out-of-pocket costs for the enrollees, or a lower premium with higher out-of-pocket costs for the their employees or enrollees. Premiums reflect the cost of health care, and increased costs lead directly to increased premiums. Employers typically choose the plan designed for their employees based on the most comprehensive health insurance coverage that they can afford to purchase, as well as how they want to share the cost with their employees. Traditional cancer treatment is very expensive, but these new oral chemotherapy drugs are considerably more expensive than intravenous or injectable drugs. For example, the cost of Revlimid for a patient with multiple myeloma is $72,000 a year. The cost of Gleevec, used to treat chronic myelogenous leukemia, ranges in cost from $29,000 to $57,000 per year, depending on the dosage. Most prescription drugs are traditional chemical-based compounds that after a certain amount of time can be manufactured generically. Biologics are complex biotech drugs which are genetically engineered and produced in living cells. Unlike traditional chemical-based drugs, there is not yet a legal process for generic drug manufacturers to receive U.S. Food and Drug Administration approval to market competing versions of brand-name biological drugs. So there's a discrepancy between the oral chemotherapy drugs are typically a form of these biologics, and they're enormously expensive versus the other types of more traditional chemical compound drugs, and many of them can be produced at a generic level. Generally, the enrollee cost share of the enrollee cost share of a benefit will differ based on the underlying cost of the service or treatment, where it is delivered, and how it's delivered. Typically, medical benefits are covered on a co-payment basis, for example, a $20 co-pay for an office visit, or on a co-insurance basis, for example, on an 80-20 basis, with the enrollee paying 20% of the cost, until an out-of-pocket threshold is reached. And then after that, 100% of the inpatient services are covered. And I just want to refer to the document that Mr. Ahrens distributed with some of the profiles of a couple of different cancer patients, and I have to say that I don't understand the first two examples. The person who has a monthly out-of-pocket cost of $4,800, the 48-year-old male taking Nexavar, that would add up to about an out-of-pocket cost, of about $57,600 a year, and that just wouldn't be allowed under a fully insured, regulated health plan. And so I really am wondering if this is somebody who is covered under a self-insured plan. We don't know enough information about these examples, but that would not be allowed in the fully insured market. The second example, Revlimid, leads me to think that this is an ERISA case where the annual cost is $72,000 for Revlimid. 20% of $72,000 is $14,400. And if you divide that by 12, that equals $1,200 a month. And so my thinking is that this particular example is actually something that's occurring in the self-funded market over which this legislation has no control. So I just wanted to make that point. Oral chemotherapy drugs are different coverage and or enrollee cost sharing for different classifications of benefits is a standard method for controlling costs in healthcare coverage. And just recently in some new federal rules regarding mental health parity that were recently released in early February, stated in the preamble of these rules that in fact, determining the predominant financial requirements and treatment limitations for the entire plan without taking these classification distinctions into account could potentially lead to absurd results. And so what that means is that when we're looking, when the cost of a plan is being developed, medical costs or medical benefits are going to be looked at against other medical benefits. Prescription costs are going to be looked at the out-of-pocket costs and enrollee cost sharing are going to be developed based on what the other prescription drugs are. And they're going to be treated fairly that way. So that's what that is getting at. This bill moves away from the most recent movement on parity by ignoring different benefit classifications and different financial types. of coinsurance or enrollee cost sharing. I'll close quickly here by saying making these two types of coverage, both pharmacy and a clinic or inpatient hospital benefit, identical is problematic, and here's why. Determining what is equal is challenging. Is a 30-day supply of a drug the same as one visit for an IV or an injection? Is it two visits? Is it equal to three or six? The answer could vary greatly depending on the specific treatment and the drug. And the actual cost of treatments is very different. Oral chemotherapy pills are much more expensive than the IV or injection chemotherapy. I will also add that cancer is not the only disease that can be treated with both outpatient pills versus an clinic or inpatient or home-based injection or infusion. Equalizing the consumer's cost hides the underlying cost of the treatment and its impact on the premiums. Finally, I just want to say that this bill could result in unintended consequences whereby the enrollee cost sharing for chemotherapy actually increases. And I have talked with Mr. Ahrens about this and a little bit with Representative Fritz. I don't think this is their intention, but we think that the language would have this effect. And that is, for example, one plan reports that their enrollees are only responsible for about 4.4% of the cost of these oral chemotherapies under a pharmacy benefit. Their data also shows that just over a quarter of individuals receive these services in either outpatient or at-home therapy, in which most cases assesses a 20% coinsurance. So on the one hand, you have somebody getting oral chemotherapy, that's and their cost, enrollee cost sharing, may be $200 a month, but it totals to a 4.4% total cost sharing. Someone else who's getting it in a hospital setting would pay a 20% coinsurance. If the oral chemotherapy pharmacy benefit is tied to the cost sharing for these medical benefits, the result would be higher out-of-pocket costs for the enrollees. You know, the bottom line is that health plans cover these medications that help patients battle cancer. Oral chemo drugs are expensive. Chemotherapy treatments are covered in different ways depending on where it's received. This bill could actually result in patients paying more out-of-pocket costs. And regardless of what you do, the intent of this bill would place upward pressure on premiums, and so for that reason we oppose it. I would just say that this really is an issue of how to share the costs of a very expensive treatment between the purchaser, the employer, and the patient. This is about who pays the bill. It is a balancing act. The more invisible the cost is to the patient, the more the employer will have to pay. If you pass this bill, you are making the decision to shift more of the cost of health care to the employer. There are no easy answers. Either decision you make today will have consequences.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have a question from Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure I'm going to do a very good job with asking my question, but I'm trying to get at, I understand one's a pharmaceutical and one's paid as a medical treatment, so I'm understanding that. I guess I'm wondering if efficacy is weighs in at all this. I would assume you would prescribe the oral treatment because the outcome is better than that of a traditional chemo. And so even though the pill version may cost more for the insurance company because they are expensive because they're newer, if the outcome is better, the long-term result would be an increase or a decrease in healthcare costs overall. So I'm wondering if efficacy weighs into any of this, or if it's just simply one's a pharmaceutical, one's a, and this is how we do it, or if you're willing or would at some point in the future look at, even though the pill may be more expensive because they're newer, the outcome is so much better that it would make sense to do that. And I'm not sure what I'm asking, that there's just a simple simple answer to that, but it just seems to me that how well a product works should weigh into whether it's worth paying a little bit more for it in the long run. And then I also wondered if someone could answer the question as to, I know some people that are on pill form chemos right now, but many of them are trials, and how that is covered. So that's just more of a curiosity.
Anyone care to attack that?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Norton. To your first question about efficacy, these oral chemotherapy medications are really amazing medications, and they do wonderful things. And so the physician is the person making the decision about what is the most appropriate therapy for that particular patient. The health plan doesn't get involved in that decision. And as you heard from the previous testifiers, these drugs can do some amazing things. There's no doubt about it. At the same time, these drugs are enormously expensive. And, you know, I think if there were, if these were medications where there wasn't strong evidence for the efficacy of these medications, I think that would be another story. But I think these drugs have gone through the process far enough where, you know, they've been in clinical trials and they've been approved by the FDA and things like, or by the government and different, you know, they qualify and they really do produce amazing results. And so it's not a question of whether or not these drugs should be given to people. I think the point I'm trying to make is for us to all understand that all of these wonderful medical blockbuster drugs and other things that we have in this country are really wonderful, and they also cost a lot of money. And it's just the issue here is not whether or not we pay for them, because we do. The issue is when employers are purchasing benefits for their employees, they're trying to balance how much do I pay in the form of the premium, and how do I adjust those benefits and have a little more cost sharing for the enrollees. And some are very, most employers want to be very generous. They want to treat their employees. They want to provide good benefits. And as Ms. Fertel will testify, in this economy, that's getting more and more difficult. So I'm just simply saying to you, if this bill passes, you're just pushing down over here, but those costs aren't going to go away. They're going to get spread to some other place.
Okay.
And I can also respond to your comment about...
I just want to move us along a little bit, because Ms. Fertel wants to speak, and then we have another bill. So if you could just follow up real briefly, Representative Norton.
I'm still curious, though, because the costs are going to be paid, as you mentioned, by somebody. Mm-hmm. If the treatment, the oral cancer treatment, no matter how, whether pharmaceutical or however you want to pay for it, is going to lower the person's health care costs, keep them out of the hospital, spending time in a room with, you know, the liquid chemos, and the results are better in the long run, their health care costs in the end are going to be less. And so I guess I'm just curious as to how you weigh that, or if whether you do.
Oh, Madam Chair and Representative Norton, I know that I don't know the answer to that question. I think that it may not necessarily be the case that the costs are actually less.
Okay, I'm going to turn to Representative Murphy, who also had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is for Ms. Commit, and it might be a question that is too complex to answer now. But as we talk about this and new emerging modalities of treatment, I am curious about how health plans sort of bring those new drugs and treatments into the pricing of your products. How does, and again, that's a dissertation question, so we can talk about it more later, but just if you could give us a little thumbnail about how do you do that? Because things are always changing. There's all sorts of new stuff coming to market. So how does that work?
Ms. Smith.
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy. This is over my pay grade, but let me give it a little shot, and I'll be brief. There are medical policies and medical directors at the health plans who are perusing the medical literature and watching and for all the latest and greatest treatments and drugs and things that come on the market. Patients know about them. Doctors know about them. And when a drug, for example, meets the is FDA approved or shows real promise in helping to treat cancer, the health plan is going to look at that very carefully and most likely cover it because the evidence is so overwhelmingly positive. And so they have, health plans have processes in place where they're constantly reviewing the literature and the medical science to find what is the latest and best information out there about what should be covered, and they do cover it. And so they're always adding new things to their list of benefits and things like that as they come online.
Okay. Ms. Fertel, why don't you go ahead, introduce yourself to the tape, and please, if you can, try not to repeat anything, that'd be great.
Okay, I'll do my best. Madam Chair and members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Cecilia Rattel, and I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm new to the chamber, and as I look around, I know I've met a lot of you, but look forward to meeting the rest of you, hopefully sometime soon. The Minnesota Chamber represents 2,400 businesses throughout the state of Minnesota. We're concerned that the enactment of this bill will lead to increased costs at a time when employers and individuals are struggling to maintain health care coverage. Employers want to do well by their employees, but in this downturn economy, employers are having to decide between laying some people off to keep health coverage for others or keep as many people employed as possible, but to drop coverage. These are very difficult decisions. Last month, the Minnesota Department of Health reported that our uninsured rate increased to 480,000 Minnesotans, or 9.1%, in 2009, which is an increase from 374,000 Minnesotans, or 7.2%, in 2007. The Department of Health also recently reported that Minnesotans who work at companies with 2 to 10 employees now represent 28% of people who are employed but uninsured. That's up from 22% in 2007. When compared to employers of all sizes, employees in the 2 to 10 group were the most likely to lose their coverage. You should all have a pie chart in your packet that shows where Minnesotans get their health care coverage. If this bill were enacted, it would only apply to less than 27% of the population in Minnesota. That's because state laws and regulations only apply to products in the fully insured market, which are typically purchased by small employers and individuals. 41% of the population is covered by large, self-funded employers that are exempt from state laws and regulations due to the federal ERISA laws. This bill will increase the cost of coverage for only those in the fully insured market. This bill would limit the ability of health plans to continue to use the tools necessary to help curb costs, including enrollee cost-sharing levels. Clearly, more must be done to control or contain health care costs. This bill focuses on the financing and the pushing down on the cost of oral chemotherapy drugs, but it does shift that cost to employers. It is for this reason that we oppose this bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions, members? All right. Seeing none, Representative Fritz renews her motion that House File 1847, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
The ayes prevail and the motion prevails. Thank you, Representative
Thank you,
Fritz.
Members. Thank you, ma'am.
Okay, next bill is House File 1217, Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While we're getting my computer booted up, I could do a little housekeeping here on an author's amendment.
Sure. Go ahead, Representative Gardner. First, we need to move your bill. Would you like to move your bill?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 1217 that will be recommended to pass and be sent to the Committee on Public Safety, Representative Hillstrom's committee.
Okay. Representative Gardner moves that House File 1217 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. And then the A5 amendment. Representative Gardner?
That's correct. I'd like to move the H-1217-A5 amendment. And would it be helpful if I explained it a little bit? Because there's some stakeholders who want to make sure they know what's in it and so on.
Well,
or should we just adopt it?
Let's adopt the amendment, and then you can explain the bill as amended. How about that?
Very good, Madam Chair.
To move things along. So Representative Gardner moves the A5 amendment to get the bill in the order in which he'd like to discuss it. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. To your bill as amended, Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll wing my introduction here to save a little time. This took about 2.5 hours in the Environment Committee, and I think it'll be considerably shorter today. Madam Chair and members of the committee, this bill has to do with the collection of unused prescription and over-the-counter drugs to avoid having them end up in our sewage system. which has led in part to the problem of endocrine disruption in our aquatic life, including our fish. It also is designed to focus on public safety because of the increase in abuse of prescription drugs. And thirdly, the bill lays the groundwork for helping us focus on reducing health care costs over time, because as I've peeled back the layers here on this issue over the last year, I've discovered that there's actually a lot of drugs that we have paid for, either as ratepayers or taxpayers, that are never used. And some of them can be returned to a pharmacy, but a lot of them aren't, and they're going down into the sewer system by flushing in healthcare facilities in people's homes. So as we move forward with this bill and move beyond that during the interim, I've had pledges from lots of stakeholders, including pharmacists, hospitals, nursing homes, and medical providers, to figure out ways that we can kind of unravel all the knots we've tied ourselves in healthcare and public safety and environmental areas, to try and figure out processes, systems, training, and technology that will help us reduce that waste over time. However, that part's not in the bill. Since we're not in the Environment Committee, I won't beat you to death on the issue of endocrine disruption, but we have had studies done throughout the country, including by the U.S. Geological Survey, the University of Minnesota, and St. Cloud State, that have shown that we have fish that are demonstrating sex characteristics of both genders. So we've had male fish showing female sex characteristics. I'll lighten up the proceedings here and tell you that the only silver lining to that, when we have estrogen compounds feminizing our male fish, that now our fish ask for directions when they swim upstream. So. Okay. All right. I told that better than in the Environment Committee.
Do you have any health jokes?
Now, there isn't necessarily any data that suggests that we are having problems with drinking water necessarily, but we haven't really tested it to any great degree in Minnesota. However, I think the MMA will testify that in any way we can do no harm by consciously flushing stuff into the toilet is a good thing. Let's see. On the issue of prescription drugs, I do have a testifier from Chisago County who can testify to some of the work that they are doing, where they're securely collecting and destroying leftover prescription drugs and over-the-counter medications as a means, not as an environmental effort, but as a way to reduce the abuse of not just prescription drugs, but over-the-counter medication. One trend we've seen nationally are what are called farming parties with a PH instead of an F, where teens are getting together on weekends and having everyone bring home something from somebody's medicine cabinet. So the fact that people have a supply in their house of things like stimulants, depressants, and painkillers is a serious issue. We have a couple of here's the basic crux of the bill. It, on the public health side, and that is kind of within the purview of this committee, it prohibits the flushing into the sewer system by healthcare facilities pharmaceutical products. Now, I have crafted something in the author's amendment in cooperation with the care providers and the thumbs up and the Aging Services of Minnesota, which addresses their concerns that we not run afoul of federal law. The feds at the Drug Enforcement Agency have fairly stringent rules as to I'm going to switch.
Great. Excuse me just a moment.
There we go. The author's amendment pretty much says that there would be no flushing in healthcare facilities 6 months after the Drug Enforcement Agency adopts new rules as to alternative methods of disposal. Right now, a nursing home or a hospital could avoid flushing if they get a letter from the agent in charge from the DEA in Minneapolis. And if every facility did that, I think it would be a bureaucratic nightmare. The DEA is undergoing a rulemaking process. They're still taking comments right now to figure out how they can make sure that we're maintaining control over controlled substances, but still allow healthcare facilities to safely store, transport, and destroy this material. So we're trying to conform with federal law, and it should meet the needs of the nursing home. So, all right, let me jump in.
Okay.
Another important part of the bill actually will be dealt with in public safety has to, I would say, have some of our statute conform with federal law as it relates to possession of controlled substances. That's why it would go to the Public Safety Committee. But right now, only a pharmacist can possess controlled substances for the purposes of destruction or for any other matter, and not even law enforcement is allowed to possess, even though federal law does allow it. The bill also allows hazardous waste transporters who are in the business of taking this material and having it destroyed to actually possess for the purposes of destruction. And that more or less is in conformity with what the DEA is recommending. There's a note from grandma clause, I call it. Our laws related to drugs pretty much say that a designated caregiver individual or family member can go get your drugs. If you're at home, let's say, they can dispense your drugs, but they're not allowed to possess it for the purposes of destruction. So if grandma can't get out of bed, she can't give you the drugs to take to a secure facility to have them dropped off. And so after talking with law enforcement, it seemed wise to have what I call a note from grandma sentence there to say if a cop pulls you over and you have controlled substances in your vehicle, you better have a note that says you're the designated individual caregiver or family member to actually take that for destruction. At the heart of the bill, though, is Article 1, which is the product stewardship system. This is a system very similar to what we have for electronic waste. We passed that bill, and the governor signed it in 2007. The products are slightly different because you don't have to have police standing there while you drop off your old computers and TVs. But it was set up to have the producers of a product internalize the cost of the environmental externality into the cost of the product, because the externality of environmental protection was being shifted to a property taxpayers and ratepayers, or property taxpayers in the case of e-waste. If we do nothing with this bill, what would happen is that over time, as we start trying to get endocrine disruptors out of our water, and there are other things other than drugs, I should point that out very clearly, we're going to be upgrading our sewage treatment systems at a very high cost. The League of Minnesota Cities tells me it would take hundreds of millions to billions of dollars to be able to clean that material out on the back end. We also are dealing with a high cost, I would estimate from states that have similar numbers, in the tens of millions of dollars in problems with hospitalizations due to abuse of prescription drugs through unintentional poisonings. Those are the major elements. Looks like we're not going to get rolling here. The product stewardship system.
Representative Gardner, let me just interrupt for a second.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Waiting and trying to get the presentation going.
Well,
maybe
I think we can dispense with it at this point.
So. Okay, because we are kind of pressed for time. We want to be sure to give the other side time as well. So maybe we should.
All I would sum up with on the product stewardship system is it would ask drug producers to essentially take financial responsibility for the collection and destruction. However, that doesn't mean that they would actually take back the material. I think there is some testimony in the last committee suggesting that drug producers would get all their stuff mailed back to them, which is not really the case. The kind of models we're looking at have already been done in Minnesota in a couple places. Blue Earth County has had a waiver from the Drug Enforcement Agency to collect at a willing pharmacy with sheriff deputies present to handle the controlled substances. Mayo actually was nice enough to cover the cost of that. Chisago County will testify in their program, and then the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District in Duluth has used the community cleanup model where you bring in your tires and your motor oil and so on. You can also bring your drugs in. You have a sheriff's deputy there who takes custody of the material, and then it's sent for destruction. And right now, destruction means hazardous waste incineration. It's quite possible that the PCA could decide that an alternative method is more appropriate, such as municipal solid waste incineration. So it could go to Red Wing or Minneapolis or a variety of other places, which would lower the cost. You'll hear a lot of things in the testimony about cost, and I just want to direct you to the spreadsheet that's in your packet. This would be the basis for perhaps DHS or others to look at fiscal notes to see if there actually would be any impact. I don't really think there would be. But what this does is estimate how many prescription drugs and over-the-counter medications are sold in Minnesota. There's certain assumptions about, you know, unit costs and so on. And then we've taken the pilot collection costs from Chisago County and extrapolated it statewide. And it's my belief, if these assumptions are correct, the estimated annual statewide collection and destruction costs would be anywhere from about $700,000 to $830,000 a year for the whole state, and that would translate to less than a penny to just over a penny per prescription. In the interest of time, I thought maybe we could get to the testifiers, Madam Chair.
Please.
And then we'll get rolling.
Okay. First on my list is Sarah Nosneski from MMA. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Sarah Nosneski, I represent the Minnesota Medical Association. I'm actually here to testify in support of Representative Gardner's bill. From a public health perspective, his bill is an important step forward and a key component. Our public health committee has reviewed what's happening and really believes that eliminating or reducing and limiting the amount of pharmaceutical waste in our water supply is an important step forward we need to take. While it is only one small part of an overall larger problem, it is a part of the problem, and so we support the bill. We also appreciate the effort to address the conflicts. Representative Gardner described it as the knots that we're in between the PCA and the DEA and the Department of Health, and healthcare providers do appreciate that. So thank you for your time and attention this morning.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Next, we have Sergeant Schreck. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Carl Schreck. I'm with Chisago County Sheriff's Office. I'm a sergeant there. Been there for about 25 years. Just a quick background on how I got involved in this. I have a real unique position in the Sheriff's Office. The Sheriff of Chisago County is very innovative, and 50% of my time is with solid waste enforcement. I go to garbage houses. I go to the properties that are full of junk. I deal with people that are filling in ravines into the St. Croix River. That's a big part of my job. I work real closely with our household hazardous waste facility. Back a couple of years ago, I got a phone call. Somebody had dropped off a box full of paint. In the bottom of the box was two very large bottles of phenobarbital. They knew they couldn't have it. They were in a panic. I went and picked it up from them. They asked me what I was going to do with it, and I said, well, I'll go put it in our evidence room. They asked me, what are you going to do with from there? I said, well, we'll probably flush it. Well, they just about fell off their chair. We then started talking about how every day at our hazardous waste facility, they're getting phone calls of, what do I do with my unused prescriptions? I want to bring them up there. Well, we can't accept them. So I thought it was going to be a pretty simple solution. We were kind of looking at it from an environmental standpoint. I'm just a real common sense guy. Less I pour down the drain, less it's going to be there. I don't know how you can do any other math than that. As we started looking at this, it became more complicated and more complicated with all the different rules, different government agencies. The one thing is I'm a licensed peace officer. I can buy, possess, and sell drugs. We put our heads together, and we came up with what I think is a really innovative model. This bill, which I'm in support of, the sheriff's in support of, is something that is going to clean up some language. I've had the fortune to speak to over 200 law enforcement entities. Right now, I have several entities coming on board with us. Stearns County is going to start a program like ours. I just got off the phone yesterday with Maurer County. They're going to just model a program after ours. And basically what our program is we have an ongoing take-back program. We have two drop locations. One's at the sheriff's office. It's a secure, if you picture like a mailbox, it's on an interior wall. We needed a secure location because we didn't want anybody to break into it. And we didn't think anybody would break into the sheriff's office. The other one is at the North Branch Police Department, which it's my box. We have legislation to keep it there through the city council, but it's my box. I have control of it. We have collection identification through the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and it's an anonymous location. People come that don't need their medication, don't want the medication, you drop it off. We ask you to take your name off of it, and you drop it off in the box. Takes me about 10 minutes a week. I go take a little plastic tote, empty out the box, I take it back to our evidence room, pour it into a barrel, seal it, then it sits there. When I collect enough, which we started out very slowly because we didn't know how this was going to work, but when we get enough for a collection, we have a company called Veolia. They come in. They have two chemists. They actually sort through it. because one of the glitches of this is the over-the-counter stuff, they can haul it away. Things like morphine, oxycodone, they can't take. I can't give it to them. They can't haul it. With our collection site, that's been around 5 to 8% of what we're taking in. Once they sort, it takes them about 3 hours to go through about 500 pounds. And to picture 500 pounds of drugs, that's a lot of drugs. They take what they can take, leaves me with a little container left. Last March, I made a trip to Sauget, Illinois, to a hazardous waste incinerator, which is owned by Veolia. And I did a witness burn. And I maintained control of it. We keep our chain of custody. What I hauled down there was $400,000 worth of street value drugs. When you can just hit Google and you start looking at what's out there. You hit Google about deaths in colleges, deaths in high schools. You're overwhelmed with how much information is there, how accessible this is. Then from a law enforcement standpoint, and I've had the fortune to talk to pharmacy associations, law enforcement, and what we're finding is an overwhelming trend in our youth is they think these drugs are safe. They're not illegal. They got to be safe. We've had numerous deaths. There was just an article a week ago on WCCO of a college student that died at the U of M. His mother's contributing it to prescription medication and that ease of getting it.
Right. Sergeant Schreck, I just want to interrupt you. Sorry. This is very interesting, but this goes more, I think, to the Public Safety Committee, and we're the Health Committee, and I'm a little pressed for time here, so I'm going to ask you to wrap up, if you would.
I'll wrap it up. Apologize for that. Part of the health issue is what's going into the water. Part of the health issue is our youth, the access to this. Our program has given out information to keep our youth from having as easy access to these drugs that are out there. The other thing with this is it's a simple math of our water, water quality. The less we put there, the less it's there.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions. Representative Bond.
Thank you, Representative Levine. And on the issue of safety of our youth, I'm finding it a little bit hard to follow this in that if currently, and I am against all disposal through flushing, including in our water systems, but if currently, as we've been advised this last year or so, that we should be, you know, mushing up, putting in with some grease or some horrible substance under our sink and then putting it in the trash for disposal, that's something that everyone can do at their home, so they don't have to drive anywhere. And now you're suggesting a policy where there's a couple locations in a county or maybe more if a full-blown system. And in terms of what we call an economic transactions cost of convenience for me as a consumer, I'm probably more likely to dispose of it if it's just in my home than if I have to take it someplace on a special occasion to do that. And so if people were indeed following public safety and recommendations about how legally they should be disposing of drugs and doing it on a timely basis by doing it in their home appropriately, I'm not sure this would increase the I see this more as potentially decreasing the likelihood of disposal rather than increasing it possibly. It might be a safer disposal ultimately, but that if it's less convenient, I'm not sure this will increase the number of drugs taken out of our cabinets at home and disposed of. We can do that now on a very timely basis. So I'm grappling with that piece of it. So if there's anything that you can tell us as to the author or as to why this would solve the access issue, that would be helpful.
I could take that.
Representative Gardner.
Madam Chair, there will be people who will say later today that throwing away your drugs is standard practice. And I should remind members that flushing stuff down the toilet used to be standard practice, and then we looked at the issue of endocrine disruptors in water. Now, I am suggesting that the suggested practice of throwing your drugs away is also not a good practice to follow. In your packets, you have a report from the state of Maine, which shows three landfills that they tested, the leachate that comes through the bottom. I believe there are Subtitle D landfills, which are very similar to what we have in Minnesota, with no sewage waste in it whatsoever to kind of skew the results. And they found traces of 40 different pharmaceutical drugs in them, as well as a few illegal drugs. So my argument is that throwing them away doesn't really solve any problem because the leachate is then pumped to a sewage treatment plant anyway. There was testimony in the Environment Committee that all of our landfills recirculate their leachate within so that nothing gets out, and we've gotten a memo back from the PCA which says that that's not the case. In fact, I visited a landfill in southwestern Minnesota this year that actually takes a tanker truck with all the leachate they take and takes it all the way to St. Paul to take it to the Metro wastewater treatment plant. So that material is getting into the system, and I would just politely to suggest to the folks who are coming after Sergeant Schreck that the idea of throwing stuff away may be a published practice right now, but it's one that we should get away from. In terms of the diversion, you know, there's nothing in the bill that says that we're going to go into people's homes and stop them from flushing or throwing away either. But our success in Minnesota with lots of materials like other household hazardous waste is to give people an opportunity to get rid of their material for free so that they won't dump more oil down the storm drain and things like that. And so that's what this bill is really modeled to do.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Representative Bunn, if you could be
thank
kind of brief.
You. Well, I'll try to follow up on the issue. Maybe we're going to get more into the minute on the landfill side. I've checked, I believe, approximately 25% of our landfills in the state, municipal solid waste, do divert their leachate to our water systems through the wastewater treatment system, something in that range. And my only question here, and I support, like I said, I think all medical facilities for sure shouldn't be, you know, we should be disposing of it through incineration or whatever, some other procedure, and not going to near wastewater at all. But in terms of this piece of it, the residential piece of it, another alternative would be we don't allow leachate to be diverted from any landfills to, you know, to our wastewater system. So I don't know if we know the cost, if that might be as effective or even more effective for getting all the household stuff. I don't know how to weigh the cost of this approach to resolving it through something like that on the residential side. That's the issue I'm raising here in response to the remarks we just made. I don't know if I have enough information yet to know.
Madam Chair, Representative Bunn, a lot of that would fall within the purview of the Environment Committee, but I think most people who deal with waste would say that if you can keep material from disposal, you tend to avoid paying costs later. I think certainly in your neck of the woods in the East Metro, people assume that there were landfills that were up to speed, and suddenly there are PFCs that are throughout southern Washington County. So I'm a believer that if people think you can bottle it up sooner or later, I think that belief is going to come back to haunt you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gardner, I won't make it a question so we don't get into a lengthy exchange. I just have a couple of concerns about the bill. First of all, I think there are some unintended consequences. You're talking about a very big issue, one that certainly deserves to be addressed. I'm not belittling that at all. I'm not sure that this is the correct solution. Some of the unintended consequences go to things more than just a cost, which isn't the purview of this committee.
And
but
Representative Gottwald, if I could just remind you, we haven't heard from the opponents yet, so I'm sure we will be hearing some of this.
Hopefully the opponents can maybe bring this up as well, but for example, the science shows that up to 95% of what is in the water has not come from people disposing of this stuff improperly, but having used it, and their own waste is the thing providing the contamination. So if we're really looking at getting at this from a public health perspective, there's a lot more to do here than just this.
Madam Chair, just a quick comment.
Gardner.
Pharma has said that 90% is excreted. I've never argued that it doesn't make up a big part, but no one's ever showed me any data to show where they get it either.
So. Okay, and we have one more testifier. Representative Gardner, you have one more. Catherine Zimmer. And, yeah, I apologize, Ms. Zimmer, but I'm going to have to ask you to be very quick, you know, like 1 or 2 minutes so that we can give the other side a fair opportunity.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Zimmer. I am the healthcare specialist for the Minnesota Technical Assistance Program. We are housed in the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota, and I've been in this role for 12 years. The MNTAP's primary mission is to assist Minnesota businesses with what we call source reduction, which is essentially eliminating waste at the source. And as I said, I've been working as a healthcare specialist, so I've been working with healthcare facilities, everything from clinics to hospitals to long-term care facilities these last 12 years on helping them reduce waste at the source. And we've done a number of very key studies indicating that a lot of pharmaceutical waste associated with healthcare facilities can be reduced at the source. In other words, a lot of the pharmaceutical waste that these facilities generate is stuff that they have purchased but have had to dispose of because of inventory issues, prescription, over-ordering in prescriptions, et cetera, et cetera. So this is kind of segueing in a little bit to what Representative Gardner discussed about later on discussing going through some source reduction conversations. But I just wanted to say a couple things that, first of all, we don't know the relative proportions of where these pharmaceuticals in our drinking water are coming from. That has not been assessed. I'm on a national committee that's looking at this issue. Secondarily, it is a public health concern, and that's why MNTAP is housed in the School of Public Health, is because we acknowledge that pollution does impact public health. And I just wanted to give you some case studies. Just an example of a long-term care facility that we worked with this last summer. We helped them look at the options available to them rather than sewering. Most long-term care facilities at this point pour almost all of their pharmaceutical waste down the sewer. So we helped them look at options for not having to do that, and they can do that by implementing what is called an automated distribution system, which is like a vending machine for pharmaceuticals. And in this instance, we found that they ultimately, after implementing the system of about which would cost about $60,000, would save $20,000 a year. And the bottom line, really, I think when we're talking about the waste, would have reduced 35,000 tablets of waste a year, which is what people have paid for. Those are, you know, that's drugs that private payers and Medicaid paid for, but now we're being sent to the sanitary sewer. That averaged out to $200 per resident in their facility per year. And I just wanted to say that the other studies that we've done with Hennepin County Medical Center and Tri-County Hospital showed relative savings of drug costs and waste costs of about $100,000 and $40,000. And when the sergeant was talking about reducing 500 pounds of pharmaceuticals, that's what we reduced at Hennepin County, and it is a lot of medication. So I just want to point out that that options are being looked at to reduce not only the healthcare business waste, and those options are available, but also I've done some work with the Minnesota Medical Association looking at how we might be able to reduce the waste associated with residential prescriptions. And I think that's all I need to say. If you have any questions.
Okay, Representative Brott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the testifier talking about what's already available out there rather than putting an additional bureaucratic program in place. But what I'm curious about is that study that you mentioned, and I didn't catch the name of the organization. I'm curious when you expect that study to be complete, because I think what I heard you say is that we really don't know where all these pharmaceuticals are coming from. And so we might be putting ourselves in front of the knowledge that we need in order to actually accomplish something and make it work effectively.
I'm not aware of the specific studies. I know that pharma has done some studies, but I also believe that the U.S. Geological Survey and the Environmental Protection Agency are doing studies to try and attribute the relative, you know, the relative components. It's a very difficult thing to do, as you can imagine, because we just don't have a lot of really good data yet on how much is prescribed, how much is taken, how much is disposed. Although we know that these chemicals exist in our water, we really don't know, historically we have not had a good handle on, you know, where everything is being dispensed and disposed. So we just might have to stay tuned. But, you know, just from the perspective that I work on, you know, we just try to eliminate it at the source. So looking at, you know, improving public health is key to this issue. And that's where I think we could get a lot more mileage, is looking at where we can, you know, stop taking drugs and start doing other things that improve the overall health of our society.
Okay, thank you. Okay, if there are no other questions, we'll move on to the next testifier, who is Tom Tavlin. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Tom Tavlin. I'm president of Green Spirit Strategies. We're advisors to the pharmaceutical sector. I'm here today to submit testimony for Dr. Patrick Moore, who is chairman and chief scientist at Green Spirit Strategies. Unfortunately, Dr. Moore is traveling outside the country today and is therefore unable to appear in person, but he asked that I do so in his place. He's a co-founder of Greenpeace, and Dr. Moore was for 15 years a leader of Greenpeace at the international level, and so he brings a useful perspective to this discussion. Dr. Moore's view is that it is inevitable that a small amount of ingested pharmaceuticals will eventually show up at trace levels in wastewater, given the human body seldom metabolizes the entire medicine, and given the improved analytical testing technologies that have developed over time. Those testing technologies have also found traces of other substances, such as pesticides, fertilizers, cleaning products, and other substances in the environment. It's also true that an even smaller portion, as was just mentioned, less than 10% of detectable trace elements in wastewater are the result of consumers flushing unused prescriptions down the toilet. In other words, more than 90% is from secretion and use, human use. It's important to note that to date, no risk to human health from exposure to trace pharmaceutical compounds found in drinking water has been demonstrated in the scientific literature, and that's very, very important. But some groups still push for costly and unnecessary tools and controls. In Washington, Oregon, and Maine, for example, interest groups who believe that any trace amount of any compound in wastewater must be stopped at all cost are proposing an elaborate take-back plan. It's my understanding, by the way, that the Washington legislature has recently rejected their legislative initiative. Dr. Moore, our organization, and I disagree with the suggestion to develop take-back programs for a number of reasons. First, detecting minute trace pharmaceutical compounds in wastewater does not mean you've identified a problem, or even the risk of a problem. Obviously, we should not indiscriminately send toxic waste into the environment for human health concerns. Yet, our detection methods have become so sophisticated that low levels of nearly everything can be found nearly everywhere. A take-back approach to eliminate such low levels will be enormously costly, difficult to manage, and, I stress, will offer no added benefit to human health or safety. Second, a take-back program would probably result in increased greenhouse gas emissions from the additional infrastructure and transportation needs the program would require, all for a new program that, if take-back subscription rates are any indicator in the past, will be used only by a small fraction of the public, again offering no added benefit to human health or safety. In connection with other take-back programs, we notice that British Columbia, Canada is often cited as a model. Madam Chairman, as a longtime resident of BC myself and as an environmentally, politically, and socially engaged Vancouverite, I can honestly tell you that neither I nor my equally engaged spouse nor my friends nor colleagues that I have talked to recently have even been aware of the BC take-back option. Therefore, I suspect it's of very little health care value for its $300,000 price tag. Dr. Moore, also a Vancouver resident, holds the same belief. As we have learned very recently, however, the BC scheme was launched in 1997. And after fully 10 years of having been in effect, a survey found that very low rates of participation have been seen given in respect to that program. Only 21% of those that responded to a survey, and we in British Columbia are not a survey-friendly society. Survey rates of completion often come back in the single digits, but only 21% of those that responded said they had used the system. That is, in my opinion, a lot of precious health-related resources and bureaucracy for very little gain. The real bang for the buck, in our opinion, however, is in educating the population to stop flushing and start using the household trash collection system for discarding unused pharmaceuticals, where they will either be destroyed through incineration or captured in a landfill. In reference to the main study that Representative Gardner just mentioned, the findings of the main study are in the parts per trillion, which are very, very low and not of any concern to public health or safety. An educational program should also focus on encouraging patients to take their medicines as prescribed, which should result in fewer unused medicines, especially patients with chronic conditions whose treatments account for 75% of healthcare costs need to take their medicines, even if they don't feel any symptoms from their high blood pressure, high cholesterol levels, or diabetes. As with many other issues, in the case of pharmaceuticals in the environment, it comes down to this, and I stress, we must weigh the significant benefits of a healthier population against the potential health and environmental risks across the landscape. The lives of millions of people around the world have been vastly improved thanks to the prescribed use of pharmaceuticals, and research is continuing daily for new cures at a cost of tens of billions of dollars annually in the United States alone. As for proper disposal, you'll be aware that recently the industry joined with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the American Pharmacists Association in launching the Smart Disposal Program. The goal of the program is to educate the public about not flushing or pouring unused medicines down the drain, but instead to use the household trash disposal or local collection programs as alternatives. We believe a simple education program like Smart Disposal in combination with medicinal compliance programs will be far more likely to result in reduced amounts of pharmaceuticals going into wastewater than the costly approaches being proposed by some groups. In closing, Madam Chairman and members of the committee, in most cases, the best approach an individual can take to reduce consumer discarded pharmaceuticals from wastewater is to ensure the medicine is used and never flushed unused down the drain. Thanks, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. All right, I'm going to next, if there are no, we have a question? Okay, Representative Root.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Telvin, I just have two quick questions. Is Dr. Moore a physician, and is he the same Dr. Moore who is an outspoken skeptic of man's responsibility for climate change?
He is not a physician. He has a PhD in ecology and an honorary doctorate in science. He is not an outspoken skeptic. He has a very balanced view in terms of climate change. He feels that climate is certainly changing. He feels that we as humans may have a part of the responsibility. We may hold a large part, a small part, but we have not yet established what part we hold. But he is certainly open-minded, as a scientist should be.
Okay. Was there another question? Representative Tao.
Thank you. Mr. Teflin, is this issue going to be, let's say, for example, this bill doesn't pass for whatever reason, is the industry, do they have a strategy to kind of deal with this issue, or are they just saying, well, the science is not there, so we're just not going to deal with it?
Madam Chairman, Representative, I am not industry, and I will not speak for industry, but I do note that there are some officials of industry that are following me at this table.
Okay.
So I would urge that you ask them that. If you'd like an answer to me, I can tell you.
Are you advocating that we...
I am advocating a very clear strategy, and that is that we train through educational programming the public not to flush their unused discarded pharmaceuticals down the toilet. That will get you, you know, most of a 10% gain because as we've already said, more than 90% of the pharmaceuticals and wastewater are from human use, in other words, excretion. So there is a 10% gain. It's a small gain that's possible, and we are advocating at Green Spirit Strategies that gain, Madam Chairman, is accomplished through education.
So, Madam Chair, so there is concern that it could impact us and the environment.
Well, Madam Chairman, Representative, so far we note that that the figures are very, very low, infinitesimal, in fact, and so we have not seen any harm. We have not seen any harm that's been demonstrated in any of the scientific literature, and we are always looking for that because, again, we are a science-based organization. We really insist upon moving our policy advocacy forward on the basis of science. We have not seen that. But, Madam Chairman, our minds also are open.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to call now Bruce Lott, and we are over our time. And just so everybody understands, I understand that Mr. Lott is here from out of town, and we are intending to recess after this next witness and take up the bill again at 6:30. We're searching for a room at this point. And Mr. Lott, if you would prefer to wait, if you can wait, I don't know if you have a plane out before that point. I don't want to shorten your testimony unnecessarily.
I'm afraid I do have a plane out.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll hear from you now then, and I really apologize. We've run over. Obviously, this is a topic that on which we do need a lot more time, and we do need to have some discussion, and members, of course, have questions. But please go ahead. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. My name is Bruce Lott. I'm the Director of State Government Relations for Mylan, Inc. We are a leading generic and specialty pharmaceutical manufacturer, and we are the largest generic manufacturer based in the United States. If I may, I'd like to distribute a couple of things to the committee.
Okay. Mr. Lott, I do want to just advise you, and again, I do apologize. We do have another committee coming in here that's supposed to start in 10 minutes, so we have very little time. So go ahead. Please talk while this is being distributed.
I will. Thank you. And I will be very brief and limit my remarks. I'd like to specifically address the issue of cost. Among the things I'm handing out is some of the information that I'm discussing and also a letter from a Minnesota-based generic manufacturer that's rather small that has some concerns about this as well. From a perspective of cost, as was mentioned earlier, I'd have to respectfully disagree with some of the comments as to what the impact of this might be on the cost of healthcare. In the generics, the marketplace is very different than most people think of when they're thinking of pharmaceuticals. We have razor thin profits, and generic manufacturers are unable to absorb the cost of programs such as the proposed take back program. Many generic prescription drugs are commodity products that sell for pennies a pill or even less, and the cost of taking back a product from a consumer could easily outstrip the manufacturer's entire price of the product and many times the profit of the product. Generic manufacturers operate within a hyper-competitive market with multiple companies offering the same products and prices intensely negotiated, leaving only razor-thin profits. Generic manufacturers do not engage in activities such as direct-to-consumer advertising or other extensive marketing efforts that could be reduced to fund such a program. I know that's an argument that has been made in various places with regard to this as to how manufacturers could fund this. The pharmaceutical take-back program proposed by this legislation would negatively impact the cost and availability of affordable generic pharmaceuticals, in our opinion. Generic manufacturers would be left with two options if required to fund a take-back program: raise prices to cover the cost of the program, or decline to allow their products to be sold in the state of Minnesota. If even some manufacturers, stop selling their products in Minnesota, generics might not be available for all products. There could be products that there are generics available in other states that would no longer be available here if there are only a couple of manufacturers who make something. The take-back program, we believe, would raise the cost of healthcare for consumers, businesses, and the state. It costs at least $5 per return $5 to $7 per return in a pilot program in Maine that used mailback in order to avoid the legal complications of controlled substances. There is a mailback provision in this legislation. In our own program that Mylan operates with regard to pharmacies to take back expired and undispensed products, that cost us at least 75 cents per unit, whether bottle or package, to take that back and dispose of it. That cost does not include the cost of actually shipping it from the pharmacy to the location where it would be destroyed. The pharmacist pick up that cost. We actually pay a third-party company to manage the program and to dispose of it, and that's 75 cents each. So we are quite confident that the cost per returned good would be somewhere between that 75-cent mark and the $7 that Maine has expended on its mailback program. And any increase in the price of generic drugs would impact your Medicaid program, your public employees program, as well as consumers and businesses in this state, because generics are now 74% of all drugs dispensed in the United States and in this and in the state of Minnesota. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much. And members, I know you probably have some questions. We really do have to get out of this room. We will come back at 6:30. If anybody has anything they must ask Mr. Lott, I will allow you to ask it. Otherwise, I would ask you to please hold your questions, and we will have more extended discussion. We will be coming back at 6:30. We'll be in this room. Thank you very much. We're in recess. Committee will reconvene. Okay, the next witness that I have on the list is Marjorie Powell. Is she here? Great. Thank you for waiting and coming back. Welcome to the committee. Sorry to make you wait.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate that you were able to reschedule on the same day. My name is Marjorie Powell. I am the Senior Assistant General Counsel at PhRMA, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. I represent the women and the men, including many of them here in Minnesota, who are doing research to develop, seek FDA approval for, and bring to market new medications. I want to talk first about the crucial importance that patients who are prescribed a medicine take their medicine as prescribed. 75 cents out of every healthcare dollar is spent on treating chronic conditions. One of the major treatments for chronic conditions after changing your lifestyle, change what you eat, get more exercise, is a prescription medicine. When a patient gets a prescription for a medicine for a chronic condition, the patient should take all of that medicine. So there shouldn't be unused medicines unless the patient can't tolerate the medicine and the physician has to change the prescription, or the prescription interacts with some other medication. But many pharmaceutical companies provide samples so that patients can try a medication before they have to fill a 30-day prescription. We think it's vitally important that we not send a message to patients that they should stop taking their medications for a chronic condition. We also know from a variety of scientific studies that less than 10% of the pharmaceuticals that actually show up, the infinitesimal amounts of pharmaceuticals that show up in water are there from disposing of medicines. The vast majority of the tiny trace amounts of medicine that are found in the water are there from use. We don't have figures. We've been trying to figure out how to get figures on how many patients don't complete what kinds of medication, but we do know that the problem is vastly different between inpatient facilities, think nursing homes, hospitals, long-term care facilities, and in-home use. But a couple of years ago, we started a prescription drug program at the request of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. When they saw the first reports of trace amounts of pharmaceuticals and a variety of other consumer products, think hand creams, DEET, sunscreen, antibiotic, hand soap, dishwasher detergent. When they began to see all of those things, they approached us to ask us to help them implement a program with the National Pharmacists Association called SmartRx. And I have in my bag, but forgot to bring down, copies, and I will get them before the hearing is finished, copies of the bookmark that we make available to pharmacies all over the country to hand out to patients to say the best way to dispose of any unused medicines that you have is to put them in a sealed container that can be sealed, put something in them to make them unattractive to animals or children who may get in the trash, and put them in the landfill. We've done a number of studies, including peer studies that have been published in peer-reviewed literature, that shows that only even tinier amounts of pharmaceuticals will leach from landfills. And the study in Maine confirms the same very, very, very low amounts of leachate from landfills. Those amounts are, thank you, whoever found the brochures and the bookmarks and passed them out, but that the safest way to dispose of medicines is to put them in the landfills. If you have a collection program of any type, you encourage the retention of the medicine that I'm not going to use in my home until the collection day or until I can go by the sheriff's office. If I can get rid of them the minute I know I'm not going to be using them, they're gone. They're not available for somebody, my teenage child or grandchild, to come in and take them. But we also have, frankly, been working with the DEA, with DARE, and a number of other drug abuse groups to try and educate parents and teenagers and pre-teenagers about the risks of abusing prescription medicines. Just because FDA approves a medicine doesn't mean it's safe for anybody to take that medicine for any purpose. A medicine that has not been prescribed for you is a dangerous product, and we think it's very important that there be education about those risks, because in fact many of the medicines that teenagers are taking from their parents' medicine cabinets to abuse are medicines that the parents are in fact taking on a daily basis. They are not unused medicines. There is also, frankly, a concern that if you have a take-back program, you're increasing the potential for diversion within the program. Now, clearly, if the program is a locked container in the sheriff's office, it's very doubtful that anyone would break into the sheriff's office. But if the container is, as happened in the pilot program in Maine, a mailback envelope addressed to the state DEA that I put out in my rural mailbox and flip up the flag to tell the mail person to stop and pick up my mail, that's available for any teenager who looks and sees that it's addressed to the state DEA and knows that there are unused medicines in there. We think it's much better to get the medicines that are not going to be used out of the home immediately. We also, frankly, have a concern because there are some medicines for which women of childbearing age should not be handling the medicines. There is at least one relatively newly approved product that FDA said, company, you can market this product if you will establish a consumer-level take-back program. You, manufacturer, will make sure that every patient who gets that drug knows that if they can't take all their pills, they will send them back to you, company. That program, the FDA worked with the DEA to get special permission for that kind of program. But The reason for that is that that product is a thalidomide-based product. And if it were put in a mail-back program and a woman of childbearing age were doing the sorting and didn't realize what was in the container and was handling it, there would be a risk that that woman, if she became pregnant, would have a child with deformed limbs. That's the problem with some medicines. Now, that's one problem. Thalidomide-based product, but there are half a dozen other thalidomide-based products on the market. There are also products that are based on other compounds that women of childbearing age shouldn't be handling. So any program needs to be structured in a way that avoids those problems. And if you're having somebody at a household waste collection site handling these things, you're adding to the risk. We also, frankly, think that this is going to increase healthcare costs without doing anything to improve access to care or the quality of patient care. It will simply be spending money to, in very possibly, increase the greenhouse gases being emitted in the state and will not result in taking any of the tiny trace amounts of pharmaceuticals and other products out of the wastewater. Many of these products will end up as hazardous wastes and have to be disposed of out of state at a burn facility that can handle hazardous waste. Let me see if I can summarize, because I know you want to get done quickly. We think education about the appropriate way to dispose of those few medicines that you aren't taking, education to encourage patients with chronic conditions to take the medications as prescribed, and a series of programs to deal with potential for drug abuse are the effective way to deal with this problem. But let me highlight that I'm talking about concerns with drugs in the home. I think there are a different set of concerns with nursing homes and hospitals. The DEA does require that nursing homes and hospitals flush controlled medicines. My understanding is that the DEA does not require that nursing homes flush other medications, that is either a nursing home easiest way to handle or a requirement of state law. But the DEA does not impose that requirement on nursing homes. I would be happy to answer any questions, if there are any.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any questions for members? Okay. I'm not seeing any at this time. Thank you very much. Phil Griffin. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Phil Griffin. I'm here today on behalf of Life Science Alley. Life Science Alley represents nearly 600 life science companies, including many locally headquartered medical device manufacturers, pharmaceutical companies, and biotech companies. These companies range in size from small startups to major multinational organizations that devote their efforts to the research, development, and commercialization of the life sciences. In Minnesota, they provide 50,000 high-wage skilled jobs. Minnesota is home to the second largest cluster of device companies in the world. A close examination of the topic before you today shows me that drug disposal is a deceivingly complex topic, and the evidence questions the wisdom of this bill. First, the evidence at the hearings has suggested that water contamination existed and was overwhelmingly the direct result of human waste, not discarded drugs. So while we would be requiring an elaborate collection system, there's no evidence that this system would have a real impact on reducing groundwater contamination. The argument that you've heard that collection systems keep dangerous drugs out of children's hands is anecdotal at best. Setting up a state program with all of the details and costs to be determined by a state agency runs a substantial risk of increasing health care costs. And while those costs may be small in the totality of health care costs, any increased cost without an increase in access or an improvement in quality must be avoided. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to say that again because I think you're going to hear this from me more than once this session. Any increase in health care costs that doesn't increase access or improve quality needs to be avoided.
Well, that's twice, Mr. Griffin.
we'll come back to it, Madam Chair. It's important.
Could you repeat that?
Last but not least, we'd ask you to do no harm. The state's economist recently testified that the medical manufacturing sector is the only portion of our economy that has grown in the last 10 years. The need to protect our natural resources is essential, as is the need to control health care costs and help our economy. For those reasons, we would oppose the passage of House File 1217. If there are questions, Madam Chair, members, I'd be happy to address them.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Gottwald.
Real quickly, Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Griffin, would it also be fair to say, or perhaps you can give me your perspective, would this create an unlevel playing field for the state of Minnesota in terms of competition, in terms of costs and so forth, as compared to others? You represent Life Science Alley, and we've heard in other committees testimony about the potential impact of Minnesota kind of going it alone without other states coming along, or doing this on a federal level as opposed to doing it state by state.
Madam Chair and Representative Gottwald, the simple answer is yes. We've talked to the committees about a variety of bills that you'll be considering this year, and our goal is to make sure that you understand that to put us at a regulatory disadvantage would not be something that would help the industry. And at the previous hearing, we had Ed Malloy from Paddock Pharmaceuticals, whose headquarters is located about two blocks from my church over in Crystal. Their little company, and I say little because it's now 300 employees, but it was less than 100 employees just 4 years ago, is a generic manufacturer. They're located here in Minnesota, and they have to go through pretty big hoops right now to get FDA approval for drugs and have systems set up to take back drugs that are not being used by the people that they're selling them to. But to move them into something that's different than dealing with wholesalers, would be dealing with the public, would be a real trick. And we've been working with Representative Gardner. I don't want to belittle his willingness to talk with us and work on that. There have been some changes to this bill that have helped us make it better. We still don't believe that legislation is the way to fix this problem. And as I said, we really need to educate the public on how to dispose of drugs. And we have lots of things to do in the environment. We don't want to belittle that, but we don't think that this one works.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin. Well, even though we didn't have him on the agenda, Buzz Anderson has asked to give some brief testimony as well. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Buzz Anderson. For the record, I want to say this gentleman to my right is a friend of mine. We've worked together in a number of product stewardship issues.
And Mr. Anderson, excuse me, could you just state who you represent?
Sorry. My name is Buzz Anderson. I represent the Minnesota Retailers Association and a number of chain pharmacies that are members of our association. As I was saying, they've worked with Representative Gardner in a number of product stewardship issues. This one's really difficult because it's such a complicated issue, made complicated in large part by the Drug Enforcement Administration, because their regulations are so structured that when it comes to controlled substances, it's very, very difficult for my pharmacies to actually work with nursing homes to take back those controlled substances. In fact, they cannot do it. So, you know, nursing homes are left with this conundrum of what do they do. But I want to point out just two things very briefly. Number one, some of my members participated in the program in Maine, and although it was a good program, it was a very costly program. And you know, this, whatever, if there's a mailback program as described in Article 1, Subdivision 8, it's going to cost somebody money, and our fear is it's going to cost us money. That is pharmacies money. We're reimbursed by medical plans and through Medicaid on what's called an AWP formula, average wholesale price. The average wholesale price is based on a national wholesale price. So anything that increases cost in Minnesota will not be reflected in the money that we get back from the plans or Medicaid. Therefore, we will lose money. And already four pharmacies in Minnesota last year went out of business. They're rural pharmacies, but margins are very, very, very tight. And any additional cost is going to cause a burden on pharmacy, as it does other health care providers. The other thing I want to mention is Article 1, Section 3, and this I raised to Representative Gardner earlier, and that is that each producer of over-the-counter drugs and also manufactured pharmaceuticals is supposed to register with the state. Now, we in pharmacy deal with thousands of over-the-counter drugs and pharmaceuticals. Is it by what's stated in the bill going to require us as pharmacy to make sure that everything that we sell is registered with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency? If it's not, can we legally sell it? If the burden falls on us to try to figure out who's registered and who's not, it will become also a very expensive and costly burden on pharmacy. So I want to raise those points. Hope there's a way to resolve those, but again, they are very problematic. And I'll stand for any questions.
All right. Well, I don't see any, so thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Representative Gardner, do you want to say a few words before we finish here?
Yes, and I'll do this quickly. There's been a lot of comments about mail back, and there actually is an option that just says producers, when they present a plan, just include information about mail back. If it says something different, I certainly can look at that, but I completely agree that mail back is an extremely expensive option and is not something I would recommend any program use as their primary means of collecting drugs. The cost estimates I showed people in my spreadsheet has in Chisago County, there's absolutely no mail back in that. Maine did do a pilot project where they were just testing to figure out the best way to do that, and the folks at the Maine, their version of the PCA, just told me it was a nightmare because they were handing out an envelope to everybody who got a prescription. And from my background in recycling, I can just tell you it's probably a dollar plus for each one. However, if a producer chose to do that, just as with the electronic waste, producers have tried to come up with their own brand of how they're going to manage waste. If they wanted to do that, I'd say knock yourself out if that's how you want to do it. But it's certainly not something I would recommend. And it wouldn't actually be sending anything back to a pharmacy. And it would not be sending anything back to a manufacturer. At least that's not how I would dispose of it. So the talk about, thalidomide and mailboxes and things like that, I'm just not seeing that.
And Representative Gardner, I do have a few questions that came in after I asked you to wrap up. So maybe
okay.
We should go to those questions and then,
very good.
We'll have a little discussion. Representative Abler, then I've got Broad, then Gottwald.
Thank you. And maybe it's a comment. And so when we did the e-waste thing with the electronic deal, that took a while to get figured out, but I think we did really good work, and now Best Buy takes back for free these things because there's a way that instead of being in the ditch. And I'm going to be supporting this tonight. Not that it's ready to become law, I don't think, but I think it's ready to move along and to become in the process. And I'm afraid if we don't do these kinds of things, we'll look back and be sorry we didn't. And I hope as this moves that the author, I know I'm going to be very interested in taking feedback. Whatever part we can minimize in the waste stream of this needs to be minimized. I think that was the practical sense of the deputy sheriff today. I don't have a specific question, but just that comment along the way. And I think that we're generating a lot of very dangerous things into our world. We have mercury-filled light bulbs, and I think someone's going to pay one way or the other. And maybe if, maybe prescribing becomes more careful, they don't give quite as high a dose, how little can work. Those are all things that will actually save money in the long run for everybody. And so with that just comment, I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Abler. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Abler. I think that the comment about the mercury in the light bulbs is really interesting, and in my view is actually why we shouldn't do things like this. I think oftentimes government tries to solve a problem and we create another one, and that's a good example. We tried to solve an efficiency problem and created an environmental impact down the road. It was something that we all know that we don't want in the environment, which is mercury, and now we're encouraging people to put it into the environment in some capacity by forcing them to buy the light bulbs that include it. So I think that's why, for me, I look at this bill and I say, wow, do we really understand all of the unintended consequences that just moving a bill like this along, just to move it in the process, what actually comes to pass in the end, and what impact it really does have, and I think it's also a marginal impact as well in terms of what dollars we spend and what results we expect. You know, you can spend trillions trying to fight climate change, or you can spend billions trying to get people vaccinated and covered with mosquito nets. You know, so it's a matter of what impact you get and what for the dollars you're spending. And I think the concerns I have, Representative Gardner, is there's many of them. But let me just try to hit a couple of them and ask you a couple of questions along the way. We had a great bill just previous to yours talking about the cost of drugs. And, you know, we've all also been trying to move into using generic drugs and things along those lines. I'd be surprised if this, in the end, wouldn't have a fiscal impact because of the increased cost to those generics that we've been trying to move people through in terms of the public programs specifically. So, how do you address that cost increase issue? You know, we hear $5 for the mail back. You say that's too many, but yet I don't see the process aligned in this bill or stated in this bill related to how it actually will work. So can you walk me through the process quickly? I don't know that everybody wants to stay here all night, but walk me through the process from the manufacturer's side. What does a manufacturer have to do? What does a consumer have to do? And then what is the result? I mean, I'm trying to understand the mechanics of how something like this actually works.
Representative Gardner.
Sure. Madam Chair and Representative Broad, first on the issue of cost, people keep bringing it up, and so I put together the spreadsheet to be a start. And the folks at DHS and the Medicaid program have said, well, we should look at this to see if it's going to pass on any cost. So the bill does have to go to finance, and I'm looking to see if there's going to be some impact there, and that would give us some indication if there's a similar impact to consumers at large. So, you know, this is the Health Policy Committee, and we might have a fiscal note come through Representative Huntley's committee, but it does have to go to finance. On the issue of process, there are some things here that are very similar to the electronic waste legislation, and the idea behind product stewardship in general is that there be some shared responsibility. Right now, all of the costs right now are on taxpayers. To deal with wastewater treatment, we pay a sewage charge, or I guess the ratepayers in that case. If we upgrade our sewage treatment costs, sewage treatment systems to accommodate the stuff that's in our surface water right now, that puts you in the hundreds of millions to billions, according to the League of Minnesota Cities, just for Minnesota. To have greater availability of drugs for poisonings, the estimates we're looking at from other states of similar populations gives us a number of an externality of in the tens of millions of dollars in our healthcare system. The idea behind this bill is to internalize the cost of the externality so that the private sector can actually figure out the cheapest way to do it rather than have government actually do it. Because when people say the private sector can do things more efficiently in a least cost fashion, I believe them. And that's actually worked with e-waste famously. But we do have this issue of controlled substances, and that does require some public participation, public sector participation, because in all the collections that have taken place to date in Minnesota, law enforcement needs to be present or have custody of the material. If that were not the case, it would be very simple to just say, let's not have government involved at all other than just tracking the numbers. For example, in e-waste, or in California, they did an advanced disposal fee, so every time you buy something, you pay essentially a fee or a tax. It goes into a fund, and then the fund is overseen by their revenue department and their version of the Pollution Control Agency, and then they pay the recyclers to reimburse for the costs, and the legislatures can steal the money and use it for other things out of that fund. And they have several dozen employees who actually oversee the program. In Minnesota, with e-waste, we have 1.5 full-time equivalent employees to manage the program. And we've allowed the ingenuity of the private sector to take hold. In this bill, a county may carry out the program and seek reimbursement for it. A producer, a drug producer, could do it. So if Pfizer, for example, wanted to hold their own program, they could do that with a willing pharmacy chain, let's say, and maybe Waste Management or Veolia, which is a hazardous waste vendor. We've seen great success and ingenuity on the part of the private sector in doing this with electronic waste. But they also could be a group of producers, and they also could be a product stewardship organization where all the producers come together. That's been true with rechargeable batteries. in the groups of producers is what we've seen with e-waste. This bill does have to go to Commerce because it does have an antitrust section in it to allow companies to actually collude to be able to figure out the most efficient way to do it. But again, I would argue that this method is cheaper because it does rely on the private sector's ingenuity to figure out how to lower costs, because the cost of not doing it is actually higher as we shift the externality to taxpayers and ratepayers in wastewater treatment and the healthcare system and environmental protection.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Gardner. You know, one of the things that's interesting is that I happen to have a meeting with some county law enforcement officials, and this issue got brought up. And one of the police chiefs, actually, it was county and city, one of the police chiefs said, you know, it's interesting. He said, we tried to have the opportunity to have a mobile incinerator, and they were not to take care of the controlled substances that they had. And he said, but yet the regulatory burdens got in the way of them being able to just take care of it rather simply, in his mind. And so I wonder if, rather than creating a whole new structure for dealing with things, and I'll have another number of other questions, that maybe we should look at just trying to get rid of some of those burdens that are there already. I mean, do you have any thoughts related to that? He said that they were not allowed by the PCA, and I don't know if PCA is in the room, but that might be an interesting question. But I mean, is there burdens that are there right now that we could take away that would allow for a better disposition of these drugs already?
Representative Gardner.
Madam Chair and Representative Broad, I think I caught the gist of your question. And I've been working since about June of last year to try and unravel all of the knots between federal and state regulation. In fact, Article 2 of the bill, as it relates to who can possess, actually will facilitate law enforcement's job really, or that will help them a lot, because the Pollution Control Agency was saying, well, only a pharmacist can handle the controlled substances, but federal law allows law enforcement to do it, but state law doesn't say it, and hazardous waste transporters also couldn't handle it. And so the Board of Pharmacy actually wrote the section in Article 2 relating to employees who may handle the material. So we are trying to streamline laws to break through the barriers that you're talking about. We, in fact, have all these silos, a public safety silo, a healthcare silo, an environmental protection silo, and I got people in the room together upstairs over a couple of meetings to say, how can we unravel these knots we've tied each other in, because people couldn't get across their boxes. And we had a meeting with the PCA and the health department, and the health department said, we'd love to ban flushing, except we have these rules that have been in place for years that say you have to flush. We'd love to see that overturned with statute. And then the PCA said, well, we treat all pharmaceutical waste, if it's all together, you know, as hazardous, and so you're telling people they're required to flush hazardous waste down the toilet. That's what we're saying. And so it was kind of an aha moment that we need to talk. So that's one reason Article 2 is in there, to kind of break through some of those regulatory barriers that we've tied ourselves up in.
Do you think, Representative Gardner and Madam Chair, that maybe we ought to start with Article 2 and see how it goes, rather than leaping off this cliff that I guess I'm concerned is going to increase costs? But help me understand the mechanics behind the pharmacy piece of this. Mr. Anderson came up and talked about, you know, the issues related to trying to figure out what manufacturers are okay to be here, what's not okay. But here's the question that I guess I'm trying to figure out. If a doctor says, here's the drug that you need to have, and I mean, I guess I'm trying to figure out, what does a pharmacist do with trying to inform doctors that they can't prescribe something because they can't dispense it, if a manufacturer does not have the arrangement, which I'm going to ask you about next, the arrangement with the state?
Sure. Representative Gardner.
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, the language as it relates to registering with the state is borrowed almost word for word from the electronic waste language from 2007. And it's actually not the pharmacy that has to check, or if it's interpreted that way, I certainly would correct it. Mr. Anderson and I have worked on retail issues before, and I understand the question where you don't want to be busting a 15-year-old clerk for putting something on the shelf that's not supposed to be there.
It actually puts a burden on drug wholesalers, and there's actually a very limited number, a handful of drug wholesalers, who actually kind of have their finger on the button to know what drugs are coming in and out. So they would actually have some ability to track this much better than a pharmacy. I should state very clear that this bill does not require a pharmacy to take back any material. That was my original idea, to have pharmacy take back, but it was clear that we have more guns here than and weapons than in British Columbia, and so having overnight storage of controlled substances in a pharmacy was not particularly a good idea. So, and it's also not permitted by current DEA regulation.
Madam Chair, Representative Gardner.
The pharmacies actually would do all right.
Representative Gardner, I'm very pro-Second Amendment, by the way. so you're talking about the guns, but...
behind pharmacies is fine, too, I guess. I don't know.
Representative Gardner, then with the process, then help me from the front end. You talked about the county process. You just talked about the pharmacy process, and so I think I'm starting to kind of figure out how the pieces fit together. Talk to me about the front end on the manufacturer side. What does a manufacturer have to do to sell drugs into our state?
Representative Gardner.
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, under the bill as it's currently written, they would have to register with the PCA to show that they've been part of the producer responsibility program.
Madam Chair and Representative Gardner, they would have to register with the state.
That's correct.
Is there a department out there that does this? Is this something that we'll just have to set up new?
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, as I mentioned, this is taken right out of the e-waste legislation language, where the PCA has 1.5 employees who actually track the material and check for compliance. And I think that's actually a better system than having several dozen employees in a California-style model where they do an advanced disposal fee, where government is doing more and more. So I'm trying to slim down the responsibilities for government to stop the shifting and allow the private sector to do their thing as efficiently as possible and make sure they, as long as they're in compliance with federal drug law.
Yeah, Representative Broad already.
Finish up here.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, I'll just finish up. My last question or point is this. I don't think just moving things along is a great idea if we don't understand the full mechanism and the full ramification related to how it relates to the health policy of whether we have access to drugs, access to affordable drugs, which are things that we talk about all the time in here. I'm not convinced that I know whether this is going to increase the costs for consumers. When I look at the definition of what drugs are included, it is very broad. I'm trying to figure out, you talk to the generic drugs, substances other than food intended to affect the structure or function of a body of humans. These are pretty big definitions that I'd like a list of things that it actually includes. Are we talking about, vitamins? Are vitamins included? Are we talking about things that you buy at the GNC? Is my muscle milk that I use to make protein bars included? I'm trying to get a sense of what is all included in this definition so that we know the true fiscal impact, but also from a policy standpoint, related to what we're actually doing in terms of health care, in addition to the environmental pieces, which is part of a different committee. So I'm not convinced that this legislation, from the definitional standpoint, that I have all the information I need. Maybe you all do, but there's a lot of things in here that I don't think are explained in terms of making the argument for moving to this policy. But Madam Chair, I do appreciate the opportunity. Representative Gardner, I appreciate your answers. I'm concerned that we're trying to do too much when what we maybe should do is reduce regulations, get some of the barriers out of the way. Maybe we should look at Article 2 as a start rather than jumping off this cliff.
Okay. Representative Brett, I just wanted to let you know in case you didn't, that currently, as I understand it, drug distributors do register, I think it's with the Department of Health, and there's quite an extensive oversight that they have to go through just about storage and all kinds of things like that. So we do have that.
I appreciate that. I am aware of that, actually. Okay. But I did have one more comment that I forgot to mention. Comparing this to e-waste, in my view, I can appreciate the attempt to compare them, but it's not the same thing. There's not doctors prescribing life-saving drug requirements or things that are going to save people's lives. That is very different than people making a choice whether to buy a computer or a TV from wherever. And so that the mechanical connection and the mechanical part of that comparison I understand, but related to the pharmacy piece and the doctors, I mean, but there's a third party out there that is different than the e-waste discussion.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Broad, if you can produce a letter from a pharmaceutical manufacturer that they will refuse to sell a drug in the state of Minnesota, I think the committee would like to see it.
Okay. Representative Broad, I'm going to move on because we do have three other people.
Well, Madam Chair, I was just asked to produce something, and I'd be happy to respond to that. I can't produce anything from any pharmaceutical company because I'm not connected to one. My concern is the policy and what we do in this state in making sure that we have drugs available to the people of Minnesota. So if there's a concern out there that there could be a drug that is maybe not affordable to sell in this state, I'm not sure the generics have the margins that it's going to take to accomplish the fees that are going to be required. And so I'm not going to produce anything, but I am going to continue to raise the concerns related to the policy part of it, and that policy is, I think, a fair game.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gardner, again, I appreciate your effort here. I would never question your intent, but this is a sledgehammer. I mean, administratively, you've got fees, you've got fines, you've got new funds being set up, you've got reporting requirements and administrative costs. And while costs, Madam Chair, go to different things, commerce and finance committees and so forth, cost is also a function of health care policy. We've talked a little bit about that. You mentioned earlier that you like the private sector, that you trust them. We had these things handed out. And the private sector is making progress in these areas, but this is a huge, huge issue. It has to do with drug consumption, drug purchasing, drug distribution, how we handle waste in general. And I admire the effort to get your arms around it, but this is extraordinarily complex and large a way of doing it. I'm a little disappointed, frankly, that we haven't seen more cooperation with the private sector as far as making this more of a program that's voluntary. Something where they sit down and come up with ways of doing some of these things that don't require so much regulation, because regulation will add cost. We heard Life Science Alley talk about what this does on a state-by-state basis. Frankly, there's a part of me that says if you're going to do this kind of thing, we should do it nationwide. This is a national issue. The water doesn't stop at Minnesota's borders, and these issues don't stop at Minnesota's borders. So far, you've got the state of Washington and Maine doing a couple of pilot programs which aren't even complete yet. And now Minnesota's going to jump out in front with this bill and do all of this stuff, really not knowing what the unintended consequences may be to our health care system. I mean, that's a deep concern to me. Representative Broad kind of touched on it with, why don't we start with some pieces we can work on reasonably well, involve the private sector, involve the people who are involved in drug distribution and manufacturing, and see if we can't make a lot of headway through that and through education and some of the other things discussed before we go to all of this registering and reporting and fining and setting up new funds. There's new administrative costs in here I haven't even considered yet. And while we're a policy committee, our priority is supposed to be jobs during this session. We hear that over and over again, jobs, jobs, jobs. Well, I guarantee you when you add this kind of administrative burden and complexity to anything, you're going to cost jobs. So I respect what you're trying to do. I just think you need to start in some more doable chunks that don't result in as much administrative burden and potential unintended consequences.
Hey, thank you, Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a few questions for the author. The first one is related to concerns, and I'm sorry, I can't see you very well, Representative Gardner, but I am just curious about some of the stuff on page 3 where it talks about what the producer has to include in a report that they would submit to the PCA. And one of the items on there is an estimate of the revenues from sales of covered products in this state during the previous calendar year. And I'm wondering one, the relevancy and the importance of that being submitted to the PCA of the producers, and it links to the fact that there's no, I don't see a fee listed yet as to what the manufacturers would have to pay. So those, I'm wondering, is there a correlation between those two pieces within the bill, and is there any idea, or how is that fee going to be calculated of what's charged to manufacturers, producers, et cetera?
Certainly, Madam Chair, Representative Mack, on the blank fee, I mean, that's once we get a fiscal note as we go to environmental finance to see what the PCA would have as a cost of administering, and I hope it would be in that, you know, 1.5 employee range. Then we can figure out how it's allocated. I do have some work to do as it relates to how the responsibility among the firms is allocated, and there's different models to do that, and to be quite honest, we wanted to address environmental policy and then health policy to be able to get there.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mack.
So the in the list of what would need to be reported to the PCA, including revenues that they would ask, that a producer would estimate in a calendar year, would that be potentially be linked to the fee that they're going to owe as a percentage of what they have to pay in, or what's the necessity of them submitting their estimated revenue on sales of products in a particular year?
Madam Chair, Gardner. Representative Mack, first I want to say also in the e-waste issue, sales data is submitted to the state, and it's actually protected by the Data Privacy Act, so that information isn't public. But yeah, that could be used to figure out how you allocate the cost. I see the generics person is handing in the note, and their concern is that if we focus on allocation of cost by volume, then generics are hit more hardly than the brand names, and if you do it based on sales revenue, then the brand names are hit more highly. To be honest with you, you know, Representative Galdwald asked about a voluntary thing. I haven't really gotten any kind of interesting coordination. If this bill gets far enough, I think we will.
Representative Mack.
Well, just to clarify that one, that particular question didn't come in a note. It was just something I noticed reading this and was curious. And I'm wondering, in the e-waste bill, if, you know, we're comparing it, is the revenue that needs to be submitted in according to that language, is that linked to the fee that manufacturers have to pay if you're comparing the two, or do you know the reason why in the e-waste language revenue has to be submitted?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Mack, the issue in e-waste, the way the bill was, for every pound that you sell, you have to pay for the cost of recycling a pound. And that's actually what held the bill up for about 2 or 3 years, was trying to figure out whether you do it based on sales share or return share, because people have these Curtis Mathis TVs for 30 years that finally show up, and maybe that manufacturer isn't in business anymore, so that's an orphan product. The life cycle here with pharmaceuticals is much shorter, though.
Okay,
and then I also have one other question, Madam Chair. I still have quite a few questions about process, and I'm wondering if maybe there's someone here, we haven't heard from the PCA on where they stand on this issue, or if maybe you, if you know and can answer that question, but I'm just wondering where the PCA is at on this.
Mack, since this is the Health Committee, the PCA normally wouldn't be here to testify, and it has gone through Environment.
Okay.
I mean, you go ahead. I'm sorry. Finish your question.
No, the question just was, I was just curious where the PCA is on this issue in the process, is what their position is.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, I have not had anybody state that they have a position, so is that correct? PCA does not have a position on the bill.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Every other department that's looking at this bill doesn't have a position.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Gardner, thank you again for all the work you've done over a long period of time on this. I just want to conclude my, and sorry I missed a portion here, but I was tied up in that other committee we both came from to conclude that. But I just, you know, in looking at this bill, wearing many different hats, wearing my healthcare cost containment hat that all of us in this committee have involved in so long, my kind of environmental protection hat, my consumer household, you know, hat, just consumer here, but also the concern about regulatory burden and business climate issues as well. So trying to weigh, you know, the benefit,
First of all, on the side of health facilities or health, you know, healthcare health facilities, I'm absolutely convinced, you know, we need this direction there in terms of making sure all of it's removed and incinerated or what's appropriate and not put into the water stream. I'm not yet convinced on the residential side, and I look forward to more conversation as this continues forward, as it probably will, on that to become convinced. But in the current form, I believe that the costs that you have proposed here do not reflect the total cost, because they don't have all the administrative and regulatory costs involved. They don't involve the consumer level cost of the additional burden of doing this. So it's really about weighing, ensuring that they go to an incinerator or other thing versus the environmental damage or health effects of if they continue to go in landfill. And partly it's a data problem that we don't have good enough data to make that decision at this time. And so I hope that I can work with you down the road here to maybe see if we can move us along in getting clear understanding of that one.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gardner renews his motion that House File 1217 as amended pass and be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Public Safety. I'm reading the wrong thing here. To the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails, and we are adjourned. Thank you, members.
Thank you, members.